Hi, it's Two Girls Talking, episode 33. I'm Katie Kiley from 97.1 The River in Atlanta, and I'm here with my buddy Melissa Ruggieri, the music critic from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, who also does the music scene blog on AJC.com. We're Two Girls Talking, and this time about something very special that happened in Atlanta 50 years ago this week. It is the Atlanta Pop Festival, the Atlanta International Pop Festival, and this was before Woodstock.
It was. It was about 6 weeks before Woodstock, and it's funny because people don't really ever talk about it. And it was just as big of a deal, really, as Woodstock. But I guess because Woodstock turned into such a mess, actually.
Isn't that funny? Yeah.
Is why people remember it more. But for Atlanta, especially, because, you know, when you look at where it was held here, it was held in Hampton, Georgia, which is a little bit south of Atlanta. It was held at the raceway track there. That area of town is no different than where Woodstock was held in comparison. You know what I mean?
That's right.
It's just really interesting the way that people glommed onto Woodstock and that became all the catchphrase. Phrases and everything. But this one, Alex Cooley actually started it, you know, had the idea to do it, and it wound up being a pretty amazing thing. It was Led Zeppelin's first appearance in the South. They had been touring earlier in the year across the West Coast, but if you lived over on this part of the world, or the country, you didn't have a chance to see Led Zeppelin.
Isn't that something?
And that's when everybody was just starting to learn about them in 1969, too, when their first album came out. So it was a really cool lineup of Led Zeppelin. Janis Joplin was technically the headliner, but Zeppelin, you know, had a lot of the buzz. Spirit, apparently, was the band that everybody remembers.
Isn't that funny?
Isn't it? It really
is. Yeah, because Spirit has become just sort of a great band. Mm-hmm. So not taking anything away from that. But Spirit is almost like a footnote in a way in so many ways.
Although Spirit is back in the news now with that lawsuit with
that's
Led Zeppelin
right.
with Stairway
Maybe
to Heaven.
That's when Zeppelin
it's funny,
off
I,
their song.
I had that conversation with a couple of the people I interviewed for this story, and we all kind of said the same thing, like, well, you know, Spirit did go on before Led Zeppelin that night. So you never know. Jimmy Page could have been going, that's a nice riff.
Isn't that funny? But it's such a difference from what we're going to talk about next week, which was the Canyon,
Echo
Laurel
the Canyon.
Canyon.
Laurel Canyon. Mm-hmm.
Yes, but those musicians back then, when you see the movie, what's so funny is Eric Clapton's going, I think I stole that song from him now that I think of it. And every one of them was saying, I loved that song so much that it had an effect on me, and I know it came out of my music, right? But everybody was okay with that. The Led Zeppelin thing, I've heard the Spirit song.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can hear it, but it's...
Right.
Yeah.
But everybody puts their own spin on things. And
that's right.
You know, that's the case even coming up, you know, in recent years with Ed Sheeran being sued for copyright infringement or just giving somebody credit for something just to preempt it. And, there's only so many notes in music. Things are going to sound the same sometimes.
Yeah.
So you know what it's like when you talk to people about something that happened 50 years ago.
They were all there.
They were all there, you know.
And I wasn't there. We hadn't moved to Atlanta yet, but we did the next year. I was at the second pop festival.
You went in 1970?
No, I'm teasing.
Oh, I was going to say.
But I was 10.
Because we could talk about that next year. When you talk to a lot of people about the same event, and I did talk to a lot of people for this story, which you can find on AJC.com, by the way. We have a great video that goes along with it, too, with footage from
the video, too. Yeah.
WSB, the local Atlanta TV station, actually had, you know, sent someone out to cover it. So there was some great B-roll that we were able to get out of the archives that are over at University of Georgia, and Georgia State has a bunch of stuff. So thankfully, all that stuff has been preserved. But everyone's recollection is always going to be a little bit different. It's sort of like that game of telephone. And, you know, you get to the point where so many people have died that you really don't know exactly what is 100% true. Now, the story has always been that Alex Cooley, the great Atlanta promoter, that this was his idea, that he had gone to a festival in Miami. He'd been to Miami on vacation. He went to the Miami Pop Festival, saw what they were doing there, said, this seems like something we could do in Atlanta, came back, got some investors, and did the Atlanta Pop Festival. That story is true. However, in talking to some other people, there was another gentleman I spoke to, Robin Conant, and he is based in New Hampshire now. He lived in Atlanta many years. He was a group of several investors that also worked with Alex to get this thing going. But Robin's telling of the story is that it was actually him and a couple of his buddies who had been sitting around one day, you know, hearing about the Monterey Pop Festival and the festivals that were happening on the West Coast, saying, why can't we do this in Atlanta? And then his telling of it is that a friend of a friend of a friend knew Alex, who was managing a restaurant at the time, and brought him on board. So there's a little bit of gray area as to who actually said, let's do this thing. Now, we do know that it was really the first thing that Alex Cooley promoted, because he was, you know, he was at a pizza restaurant at the time, and he would have bands in on the weekends and stuff because he loved music. But he had no experience as a concert promoter, which was actually pretty cool. And this information all comes from his friend Peter Conlin, who is the president of Life Nation in the Southeast. And Peter and Alex had their promotion company for many, many years. very close friends. So, you know, Peter wanted the story to be out about what Alex really did for the Atlanta community. It's just kind of funny to hear, you know, a fan's recollection of being there that day and some band members' recollections of being there that day. And then the how the story actually unfolded of how this thing happened. Bottom line, it was successful.
But we know the people that were involved, and that's pretty cool. So
right.
It doesn't really even matter. The fact that they had this idea,
right.
And then to put it in this tiny town in Atlanta.
Yeah.
I mean, the racetrack's there, but there's nothing else there.
Right.
And there were people that when I posted your story on Facebook, there were a bunch of people that were like, oh my gosh, I lived in Hampton at the time. And it was just, we were like, oh, the big city's coming to Hampton. Kind of how I imagine Woodstock was.
Right.
That they must have been like, holy hell, what the heck's coming here? And all the hippies
were there.
Heading down to Hampton, Georgia.
And everybody was really well behaved. I mean, that's the other thing that was something that everyone could agree on. The actual attendance is also discrepancy depending on who you talk to. We kind of settled on between 80,000 and 100,000 was what everyone seemed to be okay with. A couple of the band people I talked to said, no, I think it was more like 150,000, but I'm not sure. So, you know, we're kind of going with around 100,000, which is a ton of people.
Yes.
A ton of people. And then the next year, Alex came back and did the second Atlanta International Pop Festival, which just he wound up putting on himself. And that one had 300,000 people that came out. And I believe that still holds the record for the largest gathering of people in one spot in Georgia. I think it's either, I don't know where it's held a record. It might just be a Georgia record, but that's
cool.
A lot of people. That's
and that was one of the last performances of Jimi Hendrix.
Exactly.
And that's what's in that Electric Church movie.
Yes. Well, see, that one's been more...
His whole performance.
And that's
there.
What's interesting. The 71 has been documented much better than the 69 one because no one really
they
knew
what
the...
They just didn't know what was
right.
going to happen.
Exactly.
But I heard in 69, Grand Funk was also on the bill.
Yeah.
And that nobody really knew who they were
right.
and that they blew everybody away. So Spirit was apparently good, but also Grand Funk, it put them on the map.
Yes.
To play this show in 1969. And
yes.
When you think about Grand Funk, too, they had many great songs, you know?
Oh, they did.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was really kind of a breeding ground for a lot of bands. One of the people I talked to was James Pankow from Chicago. He's a founding member of Chicago. He's still in the band, trombone player. And one of the things we talked about was just what that performance meant for Chicago, because prior to playing that, they were primarily a college. They were playing college towns and college venues. And he even said that Chicago at the time, which is funny to think about, was considered an underground band because FM wouldn't play them.
Yeah.
So they didn't have a big audience. But he said once they played the Atlanta Pop Festival, then everybody kind of went, hey, who's that? You know, one of the fans I spoke to for the story, a wonderful gentleman named David Michelson, who's very excited about his memories of going to the festival. He attended as a teenager. And he said when Chicago came out, he and his buddies were like, I don't know who that is, but I'm going to buy their album tomorrow.
And I thought that was a great quote.
Yeah. I mean, and I think that's exactly how a lot of people felt about Chicago. So actually, here's Jimmy Pankow talking a little bit about what the Pop Festival meant to Chicago as a band.
And this is Jimmy recently.
Yes.
We were a lesser known act, but up and coming. It was the who's who of pop royalty. We were a lesser known act, but up and coming.
Mm-hmm.
And we had started building a following. The first album was still getting its legs by word of mouth. We had not gotten on the radio because AM radio did not understand our music. And it was considered, quote unquote, underground, if you can believe it. I mean,
wow.
Is anybody really doing it? Was underground. It was not ready for primetime radio. So radio had to catch up with us, and hence we really did not have a national audience or any kind of notoriety because we could not get on playlists on the pop stations. However, on FM radio, the album was growing in leaps and bounds because it had become the required listening of, you know, college students around the country. They decided at some point that, you know, you're not cool unless you have the CTA album. Therefore, spent most of our touring doing college campuses and building on that sector of our audience.
Mm-hmm.
And slowly but surely, word of mouth grew and grew and grew and continued to do so. Not too long after that Atlanta Pop Festival and the other two, we were invited on the road by Jimi Hendrix to open his show as his opening act. And that exposure was also huge for the band.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
It was a combination of the pop festivals, which for us was maximum exposure in comparison to the college tours we were doing. I mean, there were tens of thousands of people at those pop festivals from
sure.
all over the country, if not the world. And so many of them were experiencing CTA the first time. And that exposure was huge.
That's Jimmy Pankow of Chicago talking with Melissa recently.
And Peter Conlin really had a lot to say about the history and the legacy of this festival. He really wants people to know just how much it did for Atlanta, because this was an event that prior to it, there were a lot of acts that didn't want to play Atlanta. I mean, a lot of acts didn't want to come to the South. They were afraid that, you know, they might not be accepted here. They didn't think that the audience here was necessarily going to be interested in the type of music that they played. And Alex really, you know, went out on a limb. And, you know, one of the things I asked Peter was, did Alex ever talk to you about, like, how did he make this happen? when you think about it, here's a guy who has no, he's not in the concert industry. And the concert industry
yet,
then
right.
certainly wasn't what the concert industry is now. He wasn't a promoter. It's like, how do you get Led Zeppelin? How do you get Janis Joplin? How do you get, you know, I mean, sure, some of the bands, Grand Funk, Chicago, they weren't then what they are, you know, what they became. But even just the sense of, we're doing this thing in Hampton, Georgia, why don't you come down? And that's really what it is. And Peter said, Alex paid $5,000 for Led Zeppelin. Joplin got maybe $10,000 to perform. And as he said, that wouldn't even cover their catering today, which is so true. And when you think about just what a different time it was, you didn't have to have this big history and this big background as a big concert promoter to get something like that done. And I think that's part of the legacy of the Atlanta International Pop Festival, too. So here's what Peter had to say when we talked to him about what Alex did to get this thing going.
I'll tell you how he explained it to me.
Okay.
He was going snorkeling, and he was heading down to Key West and with some friends. And at that time, he had a pizza place in Buckhead, and he was doing bands on the weekends because he had this affinity towards music. And they stopped in Miami, and there was a festival going on. And he thought that it was amazing that you had these groups and food and whatever. And he said, you know, we can do this in Atlanta, to whoever's with him. And he came back here and started putting it together. Got on the phone and started calling people, which was amazing.
He wasn't a promoter then.
No. He was, like I said, he had a pizza joint where he bought some acts locally, but he wasn't dealing with anything nationally. He just basically started calling people and telling them what he wanted to do. So they had to have some faith in him, which is amazing.
It is, because you think back to that time, he wasn't Alex Cooley, you know. I mean, he wasn't the person that you pick up the phone and call Led Zeppelin's manager and say, hey, I'm putting together a thing. It's like, how would that even work?
Well, I'm pretty sure he had to go to New York, mm-hmm. and there were a few agencies then. And there was a real problem in the business at that time, because a lot of the agencies didn't know what to do with rock and roll. I mean, they had been set up, and they had, like, you know, Jack Benny and Bing Crosby, and then all of a sudden bands like Led Zeppelin are showing up, and Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and they didn't know what to do with them. They had the same guy handling who was handling Bing Crosby, and you had to go to the different agencies. And then later, luckily, a guy named Frank Barcelona went out and formed a rock agency, which is a very famous Premier, and kind of started the rock agency business. Alex had to cajole people to come to the South. One, they didn't think that they would be accepted here. They thought culturally that we weren't ready for rock and roll. They thought we all listened to country music, and he had to convince them. And why it was so seminal for us, basically in the Southeast, and a lot of people in the business know it, was it showed the agents and managers that there's a market for that here in the South, that there are people, not only with the first Pop Festival, which sold out and had over 100,000 people, but the second one, which did 300,000 plus people a year later.
That's Peter Conlin. Is he the president of the Atlanta Live Nation? Or
Southeast.
Yes. See, so he's a
yes.
bigwig.
He is a friend of ours.
Yes. Peter Conlin is a promoter and was with Alex Cooley for a long time, too.
And very good friend.
Favorite promoter ever, I think. Yeah.
While the crowd, by all accounts, was pretty well behaved, they didn't have any huge problems. Of course, you know, the things that happened at festivals were probably happening there.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure they were.
It was blistering hot, as you might expect. So it was July 4th and 5th. Those are the actual anniversary dates of it. July in Georgia. It's not going to be the most favorable weather. So a lot of people walking around without shirts on, men and women.
Probably.
I heard stories about the naked guy jumping on stage in the middle of somebody's set. And even then, whoever, I forgot who told me the story, said the security people, they didn't even, like, you know, scream and go crazy about him. They just very nicely picked him up and put him on the ground.
Gingerly putting him back on the ground. I gotta do that with my new kittens.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly.
No, get down off that counter.
Get down off the stage, sir. Put some pants on while you're at it. But one thing that did happen, and as Jimmy Pankow said, you know, you probably wouldn't have known this had occurred unless you were an artist, because it was backstage, was that some of the stagehands, or one stagehand, thought that it would be funny to dose the water that the other stagehands were drinking with LSD.
the stage hands, the people that are getting the sets on and off. Oh, my.
Yes. And Robin Conant, one of the guys who started the festival with Alex, told me that he actually was working as a stage hand to help out during the festival. And he was one of the people who got dosed. As Robin said, it wasn't that big of a deal to him because his body was used to it at that point. Here's Jimmy telling the story about that.
I do remember one other thing that is maybe not well known by the people that were performing there. One of the stage crew guys, thinking it was a funny joke, spiked the backstage water supply with LSD.
Hey.
Yeah, and they wound up having to call the paramedics, who were already on site, of course, because city ordinances required that for the gathering of so many people. They have to have emergency services available. They wound up sending a whole team of EMTs backstage, and they set up cots and tents to treat people that were on an accidental acid trip. And not expecting it and not digging it at all. I remember Alex and his people being alarmed and upset at the fact that some idiot did that, which was inexcusably insane. Dozens of stage crew had to be treated, I don't know, with tranquilizers, with, you know, I mean, how do you treat somebody that's on a 12-hour acid trip?
No kidding, yeah.
And I don't know how much of the drug that was put in that water, whether it was high levels or low levels or whatever. But I do know that at some point, the promoters, you know, Alex and company, were becoming concerned because so many of the stage crew who were essential to getting acts on and off the stage were now unavailable because they were victims
tripping
of this, this unexpected ingestion of LSD. And so Alex's people were scurrying around trying to cover bases because of so many of the crew being affected. So I do remember that as kind of a scary thing.
And that's Jimmy Pankow of Chicago remembering the Atlanta Pop Festival from 1969, 50 years ago this week. That's crazy. July 4th and 5th.
Yeah, and they're going to have a reunion here in Atlanta on July 7th at Smith's Old Bar for anybody who may have gone to that festival that wants to get together. David Michelson, the fan I spoke to for the story, was so excited about the fact that it falls on the same date as the free concert that was then held 2 days after the Pop Festival. So,
which that's crazy,
too. Yeah, this is kind of a crazy little story, too. So Alex and his investors actually made some money on this festival. And by money, I mean like 10 grand from what I've been told. They felt guilty that they made money on this festival because in those days, they were still the mentality of music should be free. It's for the people, man. It's all this kind of stuff. So they decided that 2 days after the festival, they were going to host a free concert in Piedmont Park here in Atlanta. And the Grateful Dead headlined this show. They tried to get the Grateful Dead for the Pop Festival, but they were already engaged with their schedule. But again, Alex just picked up the phone and called the right person, and they were able to get the Dead to come down and play during the day. Chicago Transit Authority, which, yes, we should mention that they were CTA at the time. They were Chicago Transit Authority. And Spirit and Delaney and Bonnie performed earlier in the day, and then the Dead played at night, and this thing went on till like 2 in the morning. There are rumors that no one could confirm for me that Duane Allman actually showed up at like 2 in the morning, too, and just jammed with the Dead. And no one seems to have a photo or anything of that. But when you start interviewing people and then, you know, you write about this stuff, all of a sudden things are unearthed that, oh, I didn't know I had these photos. And I did speak to a guy who was a photographer for the concert, and he had worked for Atlantic Records, but he wasn't at the festival in an official capacity. He said he just called somebody he knew at Atlantic to ask if he can get a photo pass, but he wasn't shooting for them. He managed to get all these amazing pictures of everybody on stage that night, and he just hung out in the pit the whole time. And it's just so great that there are people who still have these archives, that they have the film, that they have the prints, that they can go back. And as we discussed, what's going to happen 30 years from now when we all try to go back and find stuff? And it's like, oh, that was on a phone I had 10 years ago, and that's no longer around.
Right.
You know, I mean, everything's digital, and professional photographers, you know, you can save your stuff on a hard drive, but it's still not quite the same as having a negative there. And the reprints aren't going to be quite the same that you have from a negative. So this stuff is really kind of treasured. And it's just really fortunate that there are still people out there and still alive and with us who kept it preserved, and that we were able to use a lot of that for our story that we told.
The footage is really fun to watch that accompanies the story. One of the interesting things about the Jimi Hendrix Electric Church movie was that footage. And they found it in some barn. The guy had put it there 50 years ago,
really?
Right?
Yeah.
But that the quality of it was still that great is astounding.
That is.
It's a really cool movie to watch, too.
I think when next year's anniversary rolls around, you know, we'll have a lot more to work with because it was so much better covered than this first one was. Because so actually, after Alex did the Atlanta and International Pop Festival in July, in September, he was one of the people who put on the Texas International Pop Festival. So just a couple months later, he did another one in Texas, then came back the following summer, so July of 70, to do the second Atlanta International Pop Festival. Then he did one down in Puerto Rico. It was called the Marisol Festival. And that didn't go quite well. And apparently some general there wanted some money from him, and they had to smuggle Alex off the ground in a road case to get him to a Delta plane. And fortunately, the people from Delta knew who he was, so they were able to get him on the plane and get him out of there. That was the last festival that Alex did until Music Midtown started
Atlanta.
And Peter said he was a little wary of doing festivals until they got the idea for Music Midtown. And Peter also said it's one of the reasons why Alex wanted Music Midtown to be an urban festival that didn't involve camping, because he had already done that with the Atlanta International Pop Festivals and didn't want the hassle of everything that comes along with that, with, you know, people on the grounds and who knows what's happening and something happens
and
to somebody.
Nowadays, and you just
don't know. Exactly. It's just so much better to, you know, get in, get out, come back the next day, have a great life in between. We don't care.
Yes.
You know? Yeah. So it's just really, it's just a nice little piece of history. It did so much for the Atlanta music scene. It did so much for Alex, because that really kickstarted his career as a promoter, because people then started to look at him as, wow, look at this guy
you
put together.
That off. What else can he
exactly.
do?
Exactly.
Okay. Just to kind of give you an idea one more time of how big this was, but that we don't know too much about it. But of course, it's a iconic thing if you grew up in Atlanta. So Friday, July 4th, Booker T and the MGs, mm-hmm. Canned Heat, Chicago, Creedence Clearwater Revival, Delaney and Bonnie, Grand Funk, Ian and Sylvia, and Johnny Rivers.
Mm-hmm. Johnny Rivers. It's always fun to see a Johnny Rivers thrown
Isn't
in there.
Isn't that funny? But yeah. Literally, yeah, no, but that was so big here sure. back in the late 60s, early 70s. Saturday, July 5th, 1969, Al Kooper, Blood, Sweat, and Tears. It's just, I love that band.
And they were big at the time. They were almost headliner status at the time.
Spinning Wheel, yeah. That's mm-hmm. right. They were huge. Delaney and Bonnie again, Grand Funk, Janis Joplin, Joe Cocker, Johnny Winter, Led Zeppelin. And that good old Pacific Gas and Electric.
Yes. And the Staples Singers were part of the bill, too. Mavis Staples and the family. And you look back at that lineup and you go, how did these people who knew nothing about putting on a festival manage to put on this festival and make money and have it go reasonably well? It just goes to show you that what you don't know sometimes is beneficial, because these days...
That's right. You're
you
right.
always have to have... And Peter and I talked about this. I said, how did Alex pull off the concert in Piedmont Park 2 days after the festival? Didn't he have to get permits? I mean, you know, you have to get permits from Music Midtown years in advance. And he said, there was no such thing as permitting then. You just kind of said, I'm going to go do this. And you just showed up and you did it, and security, you know, cops would kind of hang around and make sure that nobody was doing anything too illegal, and it just happened. And then that was the other reason Alex kind of quickly got out of the festival business, because by the time he had done the ones in Texas and Puerto Rico and then the other Atlanta Pop Festival, everybody started realizing, oh, we can make money by charging you for permits, you know, the city government
oh, yeah.
and all that kind of stuff. And everything just became so much more regimented that he was like, not worth my time. Goodbye. Well, I'll just go do my own thing at concert venues.
Better ways
in town.
To do it, right?
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's a historical thing. It's pretty cool.
And you can find the artwork. The artwork is great. The mm-hmm. posters and their the peace sign and the
yes.
wreath and the bright yellow yes. sunbeam thing.
And he kept that theme going. The Texas Pop Festival poster actually has the same thing, except it's red, white, and blue. And then the second Atlanta Pop Festival is essentially the same poster with just different names.
Yes.
On
yeah.
It.
It's pretty crazy. It's pretty cool. Also.
Yeah.
But it's very expensive stuff now if you get
original. Yes. Peter Conlon actually has bought a lot of it online, and he has spent thousands of dollars on someone's original concert ticket and a t-shirt, like a very tiny t-shirt. And he has a photo of Robert Plant actually wearing the t-shirt at a different show.
I
so
love that.
That's kind of cool too. I mean, it obviously meant something to them to be part of it also. It probably launched their career in the South.
So AJC.com is where we can find your story, and you can see some of these pictures. It's
yes.
just a trip. It's a lot of fun.
It was. It was
and
fun
then
to report.
Think that it preceded Woodstock is something that we should be more proud of, I
we
think.
We should. Yeah. More people should know about
and
it.
And I'm so glad you did the story, because the story is wonderful.
Thank you.
And you really, really researched it.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where she made sure that she was talking to people that were there. Mm-hmm. She knew they were there. hopefully what's going to happen is now that you've done that, more people can add to it that actually were there.
Exactly. And that's what I'm hoping with social media, that now that it's out there on Facebook and stuff, that because I did put a call out before I did the story to say, like, hey, anybody out there? And I ain't getting any responses, which really surprised me. And then you actually helped me hook up with people who knew people who knew people.
That's it.
And it just, you know, wound up being so great finding these people. And I think now that it's that more people will, as you say, just kind of say, oh, yeah, I was there.
Tell us, what do you remember?
And then who knows how true that story will be, because their selective memory.
She will, but she's good at that. She's good at going back and making sure. I know, but it is funny, isn't it?
It is.
Next year, we'll talk more about the second one with Jimi Hendrix, but you'll be able to see that in the meantime if you want. Jimi Hendrix Electric Church.
Right. The documentary
is
about
worth
that.
Seeking out.
Yeah. Well, let us know what you think about it on our Facebook page, Two Girls Talking. Maybe you went to the festival too, or maybe, you know, you have friends who went or have some memories of it.
Will you post your story on our Facebook page?
Sure.
How about that?
I will post.
And then you can click right on to the video too.
Yep. You could see all of it and see what you think. And you could also send us email, twogirlstalking11@gmail.com, and let us know your thoughts.
We love hearing from you.
Have a great week. And we'll be back with Echo from the Canyon next time.
Yeah. I'm excited about that.